Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 197 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases again today, and as we mentioned last week, we're closing on 200 episodes. This past week, as Pat posted on LinkedIn, there was a case that was selected, and we were preparing to talk about it today, but it was decided. So Pat's found another case, and we swapped out, and we should have plenty of stuff to bring us to 200, and then courts will start to be back in session. Fully post spring break and all the holidays.
Well, just in time for spring break to end,
yeah.
The Supreme Court will finish up its term, its oral arguments for the term,
yep.
at the end of the month, of course. And I think they end with another Trump argument. It's the immunity argument.
Is.
Isn't that their last argument of the term?
Well, that's the last one it's set, and I don't think they have a lot set for April. But yeah, I think that's right. So, and it's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Right.
So
they needed to fill up the term, and Donald Trump gave them at least two cases to deal with.
All right.
Fill up the term.
Right. Right. The first case today is from the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, Knott versus Swedish Covenant Hospital. Second is from the Indiana Supreme Court, Cave Quarries, Inc. versus Warex LLC. And the third and final is from the Illinois Appellate Fourth, Doe versus Fritch. Turning to our first case. In another case of alleged improper disclosure of private mental health information, seems to be a lot of these cases, the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, and Knott versus Swedish Covenant Hospital will consider the following questions. Are the plaintiff's claims for vicarious liability against the hospital for alleged violation of various confidentiality acts barred by the decision in Gilbert versus Sycamore by the plaintiff's settlement with the nurse that called the Chicago police on the plaintiff? Has the plaintiff brought forward sufficient facts to create a question of fact to rebut the presumption of good faith reporting for claims against the individual defendant doctor? Does it matter that the defendant hospital staff did not have sufficient training in reporting that would have called them to contact DCFS, not CPD? Those are the questions to be answered in the case arising out of a claim by the plaintiff, a former teacher at a CPS school who pled guilty to multiple counts stemming from the placement of a video camera in the school bathroom. Pat, tell us about this case.
A disturbing case and an important case. And Dan opened by talking about disclosure of private mental health information. I'm going to do a plug for my column this coming week in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, but really it's a plug for go read the PLA grants and denials from the Illinois Supreme Court that came out on Wednesday. There are a plethora of really important cases that were granted and denied. The headline one is, of course, Jussie Smollett getting his day in the Illinois Supreme Court. We'll talk about that when the time comes. We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again, I presume. But one of the cases that was granted was a case called Lavery that we versus Department of Professional and Financial Regulation that we discussed on the show. And that was a case where the department was investigating certain things and investigating a professional, and they asked for mental health information. They didn't do it. They didn't ask for an in-camera inspection by filing an action with the court. So the defendant doctor, subject of the investigation doctor filed the complaint himself. And then he got fees for having to file that action. The court has granted the review of that. So this is a situation where it deals with the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act. We saw the Doe versus Kaveny case where the Supreme Court held that there was not a duty under that act, and they couldn't be a cause of action rather under that act against a lawyer who had disclosed information that their client had testified to at trial. And then we've got this case that is both under the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act, as well as ANCRA, which deals with this is the sexual abuse of children statute governs that. And then there's a whole lot of things going on here. So let's go with the questions in order in which Dan set them forth. So there's the hospital Swedish Covenant, there's a doctor, and then there is a nurse who actually called the Chicago Police Department on this plaintiff, Mr. Knott, who, and that's N-O-T-T, by the way, Mr. Knott, who came into the emergency room saying he was having a problem with voyeurism, telling them what he had done and seeking assistance. And it's a little unclear, at least to me, listening to the oral argument, whether the camera had been, I think the camera had been found by that point, but they weren't sure who had placed it. The police were investigating, apparently. Was it a janitor? Was it some other member of the staff? And he comes in and says, he tells them he thinks he's got confidentiality. He's asking for help. And one of the nurses calls the police. And the allegations, at least, are is that has allowed the police to put two and two together and arrest this guy, where he ultimately pled guilty to 27 or 28 counts of various felonies. And let's just say Justice Mitchell on the causation issue was like, wasn't your client's conduct in placing the camera and then pleading guilty the reason he's in this pickle, as opposed to anything that the hospital did? Justice Mitchell seemed to be a bit incredulous at the position taken by plaintiff's counsel. That seemed to be what I got, Dan. Did you get that vibe from the nature of his question and the tone with which he asked it? He wasn't very impressed with the argument where you have someone who's not just pled, but or not just is alleged to, but actually pled to this conduct. But I see the point that his lawyer was making, is that who's going to go in and seek treatment if you're going to call cops on me? So what happened here is the nurse settled with him. And so under Gilbert, how could there be vicarious liability? And what the plaintiff's got to try to do is separate out the direct acts of the hospital from the conduct of the nurse. And counsel for the hospital is trying to draw trying to say that those things aren't really distinct, whereas plaintiff's counsel is trying to suss out which things fall within this and which things do not. If it turns out that all of the conduct is traceable to the nurse and the nurse is settled, then this case is likely over. And we don't get to the really interesting stuff, which what facts does need to be put forth. Now, Dan, if I remember correctly, this is on a motion to dismiss stage. A 615, right? So this is the equivalent, for those that aren't familiar with Illinois procedure, this is the Illinois equivalent of a 12B6 motion. You look at the pleading, you see if it states a cause of action, and you go from there. And so in this case, we're looking at, there's a presumption of good faith reporting under the statute, but that's a rebuttable presumption if you can show bad faith. And one of the allegations of bad faith are that the doctor... No, there's a portion of this is a motion to dismiss. There's a portion of this that's summary judgment. So that some of the testimony is that the nurse or the staff never read the statute, weren't given the statute, didn't know what the statute said. Some of them hadn't even heard of the statute or something. It was pretty bad training, it seems, or non-existent training is the allegation. And that if they had read or been informed of this information, then they would have known and given and had the number to call DCFS, because it's DCFS that's supposed to investigate these things, not the cops. It's for a whole lot of reasons. I can see why that would be the policy set forth by the General Assembly. But in this case, that's not what happened. And DCFS didn't apparently find a problem, which is kind of bizarre. That's kind of disturbing on its own. It seems the cops did. The cops did what it seems they should have done, which is arrest people who are taking videos of children in the bathroom. That seems to be something you should be arrested for. Government has some responsibilities and protecting children, I think. And this would be one of the areas where the government has a substantial role, especially at a government school. You know, they have the responsibility, no matter where the school is, but especially a government school, to protect the children from this kind of exploitation. And irrespective of his illness, you can't have people taking pictures of the children while they use the restroom. That's not a thing. And so you have a very unsympathetic plaintiff that may lead to some bad law, because I see the policy issue with this chilling people from going to get assistance that this person plainly needed. If they know that, or they suspect that the person from whom they're getting treatment is just going to call the cops on them. And so who's going to go and get treatment if they think that the next call is that when they get done with the session or the disclosure, the next call is going to be to the cops, and they're going to be not getting the treatment. They're going to be getting a jail cell. So I can certainly understand the policy argument that is being made here. But I don't know if there's enough alleged here under these facts to get around the problem that the plaintiff has. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat. I could see the policy issues here. And like you said, I think this could be a case that not the best facts and not the best situation might create some bad law here, because, as you're discussing the case, you know, very important issues here of protection. And, you have someone here who, obviously, like you said, you can't be doing these things, sickness or not. Some real issues with what's going on here. Interesting case. It'll be interesting to see what the court does with it and how they come out, and we'll see if this, you mentioned the PLAs earlier, if this, you know, goes up to Supreme Court, depending on how this comes out.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of issue that the Supreme Court might take an interest in. It raises policy questions, and maybe something that the General Assembly takes a look at too. This also may not be the end of the road of the kind of sanctions the hospital could face administratively for not having properly trained the staff, apparently. That's a real problem too. But a very interesting and important case for what it portends for other future cases, because this has broad policy implications. This is one of those situations where the court is trying to figure out what the policy is of the state legislature, because this is an area, mental health privacy protections are the province of state governments, not the federal government. And they have a wide hand in this, because this is a police power type function under the Constitution. And you can see having broad protections being provided. Generally, Illinois has been solicitous of those kinds of protections, but in this case, it has to be balanced against the obvious need for protection of children. So there's a clash there, an tension there, and depending upon how the court comes out, the General Assembly may have to look and decide how they want, because they're the proper place for these kinds of balancing to be done. The question for the court is, what have they done so far under these facts? And it may have to get rebalanced if the court comes out in favor of the plaintiff here. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with another interesting policy question. This one more from the common law, not from the statutory law, from Indiana, cave quarries versus Warex.
Hey, Podiumin podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 197 of the Podium and Panel Podcast, and the Indiana Supreme Court heard a law school exam recently, this one in the area of torts. In Cave Quarries, Inc. versus Warex, which we've discussed before on the show, the court will decide whether strict liability applies with assumption of risk to be proved by the defendant, or whether a negligence standard applies for the ultra-hazardous activity of blasting when the plaintiff is the customer of the blaster. And that's a key fact here. Is there's no doubt that if the injured person, the plaintiff, was not the customer, this is easy.
Yeah.
But not so when we have the customer is the plaintiff. As an added complication, the customer plaintiff hired the drilling company, who has been named as a non-party and who the defendant blasting company claims failed to identify the mud seam that caused the plaintiff's asphalt facility to be destroyed. So there's a blast, asphalt facility gets destroyed, big damage. The court described the case thusly. Cave Quarries hired Warex to conduct controlled blasts at Cave Quarries' property, which resulted in the destruction of the asphalt plant 25 feet from the blast. The Orange Circuit Court denied Cave Quarries' motion for partial summary judgment, finding strict liability did not apply because Cave Quarries had assumed the risk of these damages. The Court of Appeals affirmed Cave Quarries versus Warex, 219 Northeast 2nd, 221 from the Indiana Appellate Court, 2023. That decision is now vacated because transfer has been granted and the Supreme Court has assumed jurisdiction over the case. Dan, tell us about the case.
Thanks, Pat. And a couple of things. One thing that if you're not familiar with it, there is, in fact, a national model blasting code.
I was not, as it turns out.
I was not either, and learned during oral arguments that there was, and that there are some modifications to it by Indiana. Secondly, a lot of talk here on the restatement of torts, first, second, and draft third of strict liability, and questions about which provisions to use. As Pat knows, and we've talked about on the show, I'm a member of the American Law Institute. I haven't really done anything with that yet, but they're the ones that do the restatements of law. And it's one of the more unusual processes for those that aren't familiar with that either. What they do is they have an annual meeting every year. They pick two or three of the restatements. They have these open sessions where people go up to the microphones and say paragraph 3 on page 22 that we're now on. Give anecdotal evidence or their input or whatever, word changing, grammatical changes. There's recorders. And what happens, though, and again, I was not familiar with it. I went to the annual meeting last year, my first full year. Well, maybe not my first full year, but I was sent notes saying, hey, you've been a member now. You haven't attended an annual meeting. Yeah, it was COVID. But the strangeness of this is that if they don't fully pass a restatement draft, it gets carried over to potentially the next annual meeting. They then decide which restatements come back at the next annual meeting. Given there's only a few days of actual annual conference in these sessions, not every restatement that's in draft form gets a full hearing. And I said, well, don't they have like committees or don't they meet by committee or in person? They do, but there's no actions taken on the restatement drafts. And so sometimes you'll hear that there's drafts of these restatements that are out there for long period, restatement of torts, I think. There's a restatement of insurance, I think we believe, Pat, isn't there?
A very controversial one, restatement of liability insurance, because it's not a restatement. It's a rewriting of liability insurance. That's a story for a different day.
Right, right. But in any event, so a lot of talk at this thing, and the thing that, as Pat mentioned in the introduction, I think that's relevant here is, again, that the plaintiff was the one that retained this party. They're in the business of doing these kind of blasting exercises using dynamite and other things to rock quarry and as it's called, Cave Quarry. So in this event, there was a mud scene, which I take it again is a disturbance in the
force. It's a disturbance in the force. That's
kind of like a mudslide, but it creates some additional stability issues. I think when the dynamite blows, it's because it's not solid rock and quarry. It's muddy and slushy and so in any event, And so that's a relevant factor here, because a lot of the questions from the justices were, well, you know, the attorney for Cave Quarry was suggesting that all they did was like retain and that was it, but they have great knowledge in this arena, and so were very involved, or it sounds like they were very involved in the process. And at one point, the appellee was talking about, this is a case of first impression. The rationale is not new. There's a case, Sister Circus, that's relevant out there. One justice asked the appellee advocate, your client blew up the plant, yet you're saying you're not saying equal footing. And what the response of the appellee was, that they did the set design, but the blaster was the one that did the blasting. A lot of questions to the appellee about, you know, three times the amount of explosive, no strict liability. As was described in the oral arguments, and I think it's an important point, and we've talked about strict liability, Pat, on this show before and other instances, strict liability is really not a common law theory. It's a harsh remedy for people to be held responsible for acts that are so dangerous and so within one party's control that there, it's really to be reserved for those areas and situations that are really so egregious that the only way to really balance kind of the injuries and the risk is to have a strict liability. There's a restatement, as noted, that talks about all of those. The from the oral argument, it seemed like there were a lot of questions for the appellant in terms of that, and why this case is not one that would be best served by negligence standards and comparative fault. In fact, one of the justices asked about whether this wasn't a good case for negligence standards and comparative fault. And again, for those listeners, most of our listeners probably are aware of these concepts, but a comparative fault concept is that there may be injury, there may be negligence on the part of the party that's been sued, the defendant, but there maybe also be conduct that was within the control of the plaintiff that contributed to the accident. And you kind of do a comparison of who's at greater fault, and you allocate based on that kind of rationale. As mentioned, one of the questions I think that was interesting, I think, from the perspective of the appellant and kind of discussed by some of the justices, was whether the statute that is in Indiana, the blaster statute, is modified from the National Model Blasters Act. And again, I wasn't aware that there was a Blasters Act, but as one of the advocates mentioned, this is a big part and parcel of Indiana. A lot of states, you know, coal mining also has these types of statutes for blasting and places that have heavy minerals or rock quarries like here. And whether or not the statute would have created, a strict liability standard. And I think the answer was no. But it seemed like, Pat, maybe you've got some thoughts, but it seemed to me like the appellant...
No, I never have any thoughts.
Yeah.
I have no thoughts.
Yeah. It seemed like the appellant, a lot of questions for the appellant about why this court should take the steps. Also a lot of talk here about the trial court, you know, and what the trial court did here in terms of making the determination that it did, and why this court should get involved in the weeds of trying to figure out and reassess the positions of the parties So very interesting case. It'll be an important case because if the Indiana Supreme Court finds that there is strict liability, I think that would be pretty impactful.
So I do have thoughts, and one of those thoughts is I thought the high water point for counsel for the appellant was when they argued that the General Assembly has set forth a licensing scheme.
Yep.
And you're essentially they violated various parts of their license, or rather, they're the only people that can do this blasting, and right, they did it bad. And we can't go around just to anybody to start placing dynamite around them. That's probably a pretty good thing to kind of limit who's putting dynamite. And they're the experts, and they deferred to them.
Right.
And when they make a mistake, that has to be strictly liable because they violated their license, because we can't go anywhere else.
Right.
We can't go down to Joe's tool shed and get some dynamite and throw it into the quarry and start blowing it up. That's not going to work because people will die. Because explosives. And so I think that's their best argument. I think the appellee comes back with, well, they were involved in the process. They told us what they wanted. We let them know. They hired the driller. And appellant's like, hold it now. If you told us to put the dynamite right underneath the building, we can't overrule you. You are the expert. You're the licensed person. We can't overrule you. And we only hired the driller because you told us we had to hire a driller. It's not like we brought them to the table without your recommendation. So some of the facts here are going to have to get dealt with. I think those are pretty good arguments for the appellants. I don't know if they'll carry the day, but I think there's some pretty good arguments that they have to say. So those are my additional thoughts. But a very interesting case. And if you're a law school student, go listen to this oral argument. This will help prepare you for a torts exam, any exam really, but a torts exam, yeah, in particular on this kind, because it'll get you thinking of all the different ways. I really, when I listened to this, it was like, I had some flashbacks, and they weren't happy ones of first year torts.
Torts on kinds administrative of law.
I didn't take administrative law, but perhaps I should have.
I forgot that I had, believe it or not. But
blocked it out of your mind, is what you did.
Yeah, no, I think it was in the last days of my. I needed hours.
Yeah, I did not. I probably should have. With that, we will take our next break and come back with our pinch-hitting case for the day, Doe versus Fritch.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 197 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Can a defendant resist summary judgment in a case in which he asserts his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination in answer to the complaint and all discovery? Can the plaintiff meet her burden of proof of showing that the defendant posted the videos when all she has are text messages with him, and the circumstance that the day after an argument, videos with her name, her hometown, and marital status were posted? Did the trial court abuse its discretion in entering a compensatory damage award of $150,000 and a punitive damage award of $150,000 in a case in which the plaintiff suffered approximately $4,000 in out-of-pocket expenses and the remainder are emotional damages as a result of the videos she claims the defendant posted about her? Those are among the questions to be answered when the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District, decides Doe versus Fritch. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. And so this is I mentioned it was a pinch-hitting case because we originally were going to talk about it next week, but we're talking about it this week. and thankfully there were a lot of oral arguments, so we're set for a little while. It's unclear what these videos were. We don't know what they were. I have a suspicion as to what they were.
I'm guessing.
My rank speculation is that they obviously doxed her in some way, and they were of the revenge porn variety. That's my rank speculation.
I think that's pretty good speculation. I think that's a prediction that's sure to be right, because marital status and like other things, again, it ain't that you didn't buy. She didn't buy the lawnmower on Amazon Marketplace.
Yeah, they were in a relationship. They get into a fight, and then he posts videos.
Right.
I have a guess as to what those videos were. And I can understand her, unhappiness with that particular. And she apparently has to go check ever so often as to whether they're there. And she's hired a service to scrub them off the pictures because they keep coming back and this and that. The plaintiff at the prove up hearing, because the defendant took the fifth. He took the fifth to answering the complaint. He took the fifth to answering discovery. He took the fifth He wasn't talking. Okay, that's his right. But rights, the exercise of a right has a consequence. Now, I had a case several years ago where it was a sexual abuse case at a school. We represented a subsequent school district, or school district that hired him in, not where the child was abused, but at a place that had hired him, and then he resigned. There had been an incident, but nothing of that variety, and then off he went. And we got out on a motion to dismiss, but in the complaint or in the answer, they answered some of the allegations and they pled the fifth on some. I wasn't in the case to see how that worked out, but I can tell you not well. Once you take the fifth, you're done. You don't talk. You can't say, I'll answer this, but not that, after your name. You can say who you are, assuming that doesn't implicate a crime. But you can say who you are. But after that, you better keep your mouth shut. You don't get to pick and choose. So this guy exercised his right to preserve the right appropriately, but that doesn't mean there's no consequence. So at the prove up hearing, counsel for plaintiff asked for $30,000. It's a lot of money.
Yep.
Court said, nope, it's too little. Circuit court said, no, I'm going to give you $150. And then the court awarded another $150,000 in punitive damages on top of it. So $300,000 total. I think that's how I understood what happened. And the plaintiff's lawyer, as I said, didn't ask for enough. The court gave him more. Court can always do that. One of the worst questions you get that has happened, it's never happened to me, fortunately, probably because I haven't tried enough cases, is the jury comes back and says, are we constrained by one of two questions? Either are we constrained by what the plaintiff asked for? Then you know you're in trouble. Or they ask for a calculator in a case where it's the contested liability. And if either of those two things happen, run for the hills, defense counsel and insurance company and defendant, because things are about to get bad. And that's what happened here in a bench trial situation. The judge, I think it was a she, it doesn't matter. The trial judge was none too pleased with this conduct, apparently, and showed it with the award that was made. And the other side is saying, well, you don't have enough evidence. You can't prove that she did it, or that the defendant did this. You can't say it was him. You've only got circumstantial evidence. I recall a jury instruction, Dan, that says circumstantial evidence is evidence. And in fact, it uses the example of a person coming into a building with an umbrella and there being water, that you can then presume, or you can conclude from those facts, that it's raining outside. Yes, you can. That's a circumstance. A person walks in, they got an umbrella, there's water on the umbrella. It might be raining outside.
Right.
And that's an example that's straight from the IPIs. Yep. So yes, circumstantial evidence is evidence. And if unrebutted on a preponderance of evidence standard, it's enough. That's what makes circumstantial cases so difficult in the criminal context, because the burden of proof is so much higher beyond a reasonable doubt. because right. someone can certainly have, without a whole lot of circumstantial evidence, you could have reasonable doubt about circumstances.
Or even with a lot of circumstantial evidence, somebody's still searching for the murderers of a certain ex.
You beat me to the punch. Yes, without the case against for those that are a little slow this morning on this Easter morning, the whole case against O.J. Simpson was circumstantial.
It was
there was circumstantial because they found everyone remembers the evidence. It was a circumstantial case, but there was a lot of it. A lot of it. Not enough for that jury, apparently. But for everybody else on the planet, for however many people lived on the planet at the time, what, 6 billion, 7 billion? That number less 12, it was enough. For those 12, it wasn't. For everybody else, it was. All thinking people were like, yeah, he did it. Yeah, I don't believe you. So this case really is very interesting because of this issue of the assertion of the Fifth Amendment and how that plays in, and the exercise of the right is, it doesn't come without consequence. And I think that's it's an important thing to remember that when you have, I have a number of cases right now where there's an underlying criminal claim and we have to wait on the civil side until the criminal matter is resolved. And that doesn't mean that the civil matter stops. It doesn't, it should many times, but it doesn't necessarily mean it does. And it also doesn't mean that everything is done. Dan, anything to add on this case?
No, I think that's it.
So with that brings us to our BI BIPA GIPA IPA. And there were a couple things here. In Illinois, First District, unpublished opinion, Transform Holdco versus Lloyds. Transform Holdco is the name of Sears Kmart. I didn't know that, but now I do.
Yep.
And this
Transform decision, the bankruptcy.
Exactly. this decision is important because it really goes through the sweep of Illinois law on this issue. So if you read no other case on the topic, read this one because it kind of really talks about all the issues because they raised all the issues. They had all the very meticulous allegations about what how the fomites and the virus on the surfaces and trying to get as close as they could to get around Elger or to plead into Elger and show that it had changed the surface and so forth. And then also there's a choice of forum issue in there as well. So an important case there to read. And then there was a decision in favor of the insurance company in Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation that runs the Foxwood Resort Casino that held that there was no coverage there. And then, Dan, why don't you tell us about this BIPA case related to Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon tried to get out of a BIPA case let me pull it up here. Where the hell is it? Here it is. Amazon tried to avoid a class action here and go backwards in terms of its service. And I'm not sure, Pat. I would think it must be. Is it facial recognition that they're using?
I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm think so. Sure.
Yeah.
We've talked about these BIPA cases and some of the issues. Again, for those that listen to our show, we've talked about BIPA pretty repeatedly. But the BIPA statute is a gift that keeps on giving. We talked, I think, a week or two ago, Pat, about Samsung and AAA cases, and Samsung had refused to pay the administrative fees for each of those cases. What's happening in a lot of these types of situations we've talked about on this show is that any of these large companies that face consumers typically have in their provisions arbitration provisions because they don't want this to be these mass class actions on statutory violations that can get very expensive and very significant very quickly. And so... Again, Amazon tried to backpedal in terms of their exposure to BIPA claims, and the court rejected it. So they're going to have to face the onslaught of a major class action of those that allege that their biometric information was captured without proper consent.
So an issue to keep an eye on. Also, the Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, took the case of PETA versus, I forget the name of the, but it's a case we talked about on the show, dealing with not BIPA, but dealing with PIPA, the Personal Information Privacy Act.
We which doesn't have quite have the same list. Mechanisms, but, and then we got GIPA.
We have GIPA, yeah. So we have we have BI, BIPA, GIPA, IPA, PIPA.
We had a lot of IPAs in this town, and not just Goose Island.
and not just Revolution. Antihero is now advertising itself as the well, what's the tagline they're using now? Revolution for Antihero beer. They've got a name for. They've got a the city's IPA or something.
It's escaping me right now, but yeah,
I'm not an IPA fan, so which is kind of amazing because I like Islay scotches, but not IPAs.
Yeah.
So that brings us to our prediction. Sure to go wrong. We're 2-0 this week. Dan is 302-63-24. I am 299-64-24. Larson versus Crosby came out. We discussed this on episode 195. This is from the 4th District. This case arises from when the defendant knew or plaintiff knew or should have known that she was on inquiry notice about whether her injury with the impacted gauze that caused infection and other symptoms, whether that whether that put her on inquiry notice to told the stat or to begin the statute of limitations running, and the court held there was a question of fact on that issue, so it remanded the case. So we got that one right. And then a case we discussed only last week on episode 196 from the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, Moore versus S&C Electric. This is the case where the fellow decided to walk against traffic in front of the vehicle in Toronto and sued, and the court applied Canadian law. I don't know why I said Tennessee. Tennessee had no relevance to this case. Tennessee.
That'd really be unusual.
Very unusual. One of my partners who's from Canada and is licensed in Ontario practice in our national office. Maybe that's why it popped into my brain, but that's very attenuated. He didn't have anything to do with the case either. If he had, we would have been talking about it. But as it turns out, the court held that there was no duty for the Illinois entity. The Canadian entity had previously been dismissed on personal jurisdiction or lack of it, and the court held that there, under Canadian law, there was no this wasn't foreseeable that someone would rock against traffic, and therefore there was no summary judgment was properly entered. Which brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong for this week. Dan, Knott versus Swedish Covenant. I think this gets affirmed.
I think it's affirmed.
And I don't know if it's going to be under Gilbert, that's the easy way out, or if it's going to be causation, which seemed to be where Justice Mitchell was headed. But I think this gets affirmed, which brings us to, all right, so we have Cave Quarries versus Warex. I think this gets affirmed too.
I think it gets affirmed. I just from the questions from the court, I don't think they want to extend
right
this issue.
And then Doe versus Fritch, I think this is affirmed too.
I think it's affirmed. I think three affirmed.
And going back to Cave Quarries, just because strike that. We'll deal with that, whether that actually ends the case or not another day. Yeah. It might not just end the case. Which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, this is something that I found on the Volok Conspiracy, posted by Josh Blackman. I encourage folks to read the Volok Conspiracy if you're interested in cutting edge issues of law, particularly on First Amendment issues. You will find a robust debate of these issues. There certainly occurred with respect to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, with Josh Blackman on one side of things and Ilya Soman and others on the other. Steve Calabresi was on Blackman's side, but
yep.
Jonathan Adler's involved, a bunch of people, very interesting. But always interesting information there. So there was a discussion at the February meeting, mid-year meeting of the ABA in Louisville on viewpoint diversity between Josh Blackman, Philip Williamson, who are both members of the Federalist Society, and Juan Thomas and Ellen Rosenblum, who are members, active and high-level members of the ABA.
Yep.
Dan, you were at this meeting, but not at this session.
That's correct.
I encourage people to listen to this. It's about an hour and a half. The first 15 minutes are introduction, so skip that. Go to minute 16. You can actually watch the substance that's led off by Ellen Rosenblum, who is the Attorney General of Oregon. And then it gets progressively more animated after that. She's rainbows and daisy cups, and then it ceases being that afterwards. Dan, what are your thoughts? We have not talked. We've talked about generally about
the topic, so,
but not about the substance. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
So the topic here is viewpoint diversity and the premise of Josh and the other Federalist Society member Philip is that the ABA does not engage in viewpoint diversity. Philip and Josh, I think, both talk about some of the apparent inconsistencies in approaches or arguments on rule of law and stare decisis. And I think there's some validity there, but I also think there's, I think every, you know, a lot of, in the constitutional space, especially in stare decisis, I think stare decisis has become one of the most tenuous or attenuated kind of bases in law, from the, especially from the nine black robed folks that opine on it, and when it's good and when it's not, and history and tradition, we can argue about that. But in any event, I commend this argument as well. One of the things I think that Josh is looking to do, and you know, I'm willing to have a conversation with him. I'm in the House of Delegates. Is again this? He tried to get a resolution, I think, at last year's annual. I'm not sure what the timing was. Not at midyear, but maybe last year's annual.
In August, I think, to
have the ABA kind of engage in viewpoint diversity. And you know, again, I think there's, you know, one of the things that I think the ABA has been in recent years, and Josh, I think, you know, talked about this, is that the ABA has lost membership over the years. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, frankly. I think one of the things, I've been a member since 95-ish or whatever, or late 90s. I don't remember exactly when I joined the ABA, but they used to have their annual meeting at all the sections and committees got together, and it's become very unwieldy in some respects, because now if you're in torts or if you're in business law section or your other sections, you end up having your mid-years and annual meetings in a city different than the annual meeting for a lot of reasons. But so the whole, again, the whole concept is that you have viewpoint diversities. Juan Thomas, who I know very well and I'm good friends with, I think if you watch the video, he has a very interesting commentary for, you know, on the fellow panelist. But it's
interesting is a word for it. Yeah. That's a word for it.
I don't want to do a spoiler alert or anything, but no.
It's
the resolution is designed to say that the ABA should look at things, you know, differently. That you know, perception, if not reality, is that they're the things that they do amicus on and other things are partisan and more liberal, progressive issues. You know, there's been a big debate, and one thing I think I've taken exception with, I've written extensively on it, Pat, is I think that some of the attacks on the ABA for federal judges, I think, is not warranted. I think if you look at the numbers, the folks that have been found qualified and highly qualified from Republican and Democratic presidents have been pretty balanced. You know, it's, again, I do think that, you know, for Trump, for example, I think a lot of the judges that he selected, some of them didn't meet the qualifications or had very little trial experience, and you know, you can debate whether the Richard Posner approach, where someone's never been on the bench or really been in court at all, is a good idea or not. He was at the appellate level. But there's been attacks in recent years, and I think it was W that stopped deferring or giving them prior notice. And you know, I think during W's term, I think when he nominated I can't think of her name right now.
Harriet Myers.
She was not recommended. Harriet Myers. She was not recommended.
She was not. Yeah. Your cat might have been more qualified, but for Harriet Myers.
And then that's like, again.
She just wasn't.
Yeah. Qualified. So again, on that point, I think that it's not. I don't think that's a biased group. Just like the Chicago Bar, Illinois State Bar, when they do judge evaluations, they're not looking at people's party or anything like that. They're looking at the actual qualifications, right? Are they? Do they have the demeanor? Do they have the knowledge and experience? And again, there's been, you know, back, you know, several years ago when the Chicago Bar, for example, amended its judicial evaluation process and rules, a lot of debate about, you know, for example, if someone doesn't have a lot of courtroom experience, but they've done a lot of other things, you know, they were general counsel of a large, you know, publicly traded company, does that experience warrants, you know, them being on the bench? Because a lot of stuff is businesses, Pat and I talk about almost every week in the show, a large amount of cases at the appellate level involve business to business. But in any event, so that's like I said, Pat found this and commend you to, you know, take a look at this video again, it talks about kind of, you know, having the ABA. And again, it's one of those questions of you know, say that this was the perception and or reality. If the ABA were to pass a resolution of this kind, is it going to attract the Federalist Society members or that aren't members now? I don't know. And I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the ABA, Pat, is that, you know, in recent years, I would say, there hasn't been this kind of robust debate that there used to be on the floor of the House of Delegates. And for many years, there's the Southern Conference, I think it's called, which was a very powerful conference that, you know, if they didn't support you, you weren't going to become president, for example, of the ABA. You know, conservative Southerners, but again, there's at least a strong perception from this thing, and I've heard that from people, you know, that I deal with all the time. So, an interesting question, I think. And Josh is, like I said, trying to find support for this resolution to present at some future bar meeting.
Yeah, one thing that I found very interesting was one of the criticisms that both Bill Williamson and Josh Blackman made was the position that the ABA has taken on in their amicus briefs. And the amicus briefs are almost always supporting the progressive position on things, whether it's abortion or student loan policy or what have you. And what maybe I misunderstood, and Dan, you're involved in the organization, I am not. One of the things that I found very, frankly, bizarre was that the board of directors of the organization does not approve the amicus briefs. The amicus briefs are done by the individual sections or committees. And if you're, you know, the amicus, did I understand that correctly? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I'm not sure I don't know exactly how it works, but that was my impression from it, and that may be the case. Seems like there has to be some vetting committee at the end.
Well, that vetting
or
committee
higher
should,
up.
That's vetting committee should be the policy making unit of the organization, which is the board of directors. And I say that as someone's been heavily involved in amicus participation, both in the Illinois Defense Council and the Defense Trial Council of Indiana. And in both of those, are smaller organizations, to be sure, much smaller organizations. But the amicus committee makes a recommendation. We'd like to participate in Smith versus Jones. Okay, who's the author? What's the position? When's it due? And we get those questions, and then the board considers whether we're going to participate or not. And there's policies as to cases we won't participate in. I know, for example, we mentioned it earlier today in segment one, the Doe case, which was against a plaintiff's lawyer. You would have thought ITLA would have filed an amicus brief. They did not. They wouldn't, because it was against a client. The IDC, we filed an amicus brief in support of a plaintiff's lawyer because it was against a lawyer. It was about what a lawyer talked about. And I respect the ITLA's position that they don't want to take a position against someone who would have been a client, a plaintiff. Okay, fine. Flip side. As a matter of policy, the IDC won't file an amicus brief. I mean, I'm sure there may be an exception one day. I haven't come across it yet. In an insurance coverage case. Why? Because sometimes our members will find themselves on one side of an insurance issue, and sometimes we'll find ourselves on the other side of the issue. It's a question of whose ox is being gored. Likewise, a subrogation issue. These are issues that we're going to find ourselves on both sides of them, defending them, prosecuting them. We have members. The past chair of the insurance law committee of the IDC was a policyholder lawyer. Not a lawyer that represents insurance companies, a lawyer that represents insureds. And even if we didn't have someone, Jill Berkeley had been involved, a policy sideholder lawyer. Seth Lambden is the person I was speaking of, a policy sideholder lawyer. David Anderson is now a member of the organization, a policy sideholder lawyer. But even if you don't have people that just represent policyholders for conflicts reasons, you still could find yourself in a position where I take a position adverse to an insurance company, a different insurance company, on behalf of one insurance company. It happens all the time. But you have to set a policy like that.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a policy setting forth what the organization's going to take, then you really end up with a problem.
I'm gonna look into that just to see if I can find. I'll ask around if I can't find it.
Because it's the place that a bar association really sets forth what matters to it when it starts filing an amicus brief in a case. And the point that I think Blackman was making, and to a lesser extent Williamson was making, is does the ABA really need a position on abortion? Does the ABA really need to have a position on qualified immunity? Does ABA really need to have a position on these things? Can the ABA focus on what's on these kinds of public contentious public policy issues and still serve its members? Now, it's plain that there were members, you'll hear this in the commentary, or the questions rather, that if the ABA isn't going to do those things, if the ABA, there's certain members of the ABA that want it to do more, doesn't think it does enough. But if you start going down the road of being an advocate, well, for one side or the other, what is the mission of the organization? If the mission of the organization is going to be a policy advocacy group, whether it's in line with the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society on one hand, or the Brookings Institution and the ACLU on the other, if that's going to be its position, then is that what its mission is? Is that what a bar association should be doing? And that's really the question. Maybe it is. And if it is, you're not going to have very many members that have the views that I have.
No, well, but on the other hand, Pat, I think that the challenge in this current environment is the Fifth Circuit on Texas and Louisiana and bars, and like even what it's considering the very narrow mission of a mandatory bar, even for pro bono opportunities, they have said you can't do that. So I think that's the debate that's going on right now is the future of bars in general.
Well, I agree with that, but the ABA is not a mandatory bar. It's a voluntary bar, so it falls.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But the voluntary bars may be the only bars of any size or substance that can actually do that going forward. And so your local bars, like the Chicago Bar, takes positions.
Sure.
Same thing, right? ISBA takes positions because it's voluntary. It's a voluntary.
Yep.
From time to time, it takes positions. And so
the ISBA takes positions all the time with positions that are adverse to my clients, which is why I'm not a member of that organization.
Well, that's, the Chicago Bar has lost membership when it's done same-sex marriage or it's done, but it takes policy positions. And why? Because it's voluntary. And I think even that may be under attack, you know,
the question isn't whether they can take positions. The question is whether they should, and what is their mission. And if the mission is to be a policy advocacy organization, you're going to piss somebody off.
Right.
And this is not a question of whether they should support right-leaning groups or left-leaning groups. This is a question of should they support any of those groups, or should they just represent lawyers in the way So, for example, the Federal Society doesn't. There are no amicus briefs from the Federal Society. In every meeting you go to. Now, we didn't do it on Thursday because on this week we had a meeting. We didn't talk about it because it didn't have that kind of valence. But you listen to a Federal Society podcast. You go to a Federal Society meeting. It is the organization itself takes no policy positions at all. Its members do. Its speakers do.
Yeah,
but the organization itself doesn't take a position because that's not what it does.
Maybe
that's not its mission. If the ABA is going to take a position,
but Calabrese, who you mentioned earlier, was told to not refer to himself as a Federalist Society member anymore when he talked about one of the cases last term.
And he was told that because it was being confused with him representing the organization. And so because the organization has been very clear that the organization, qua the organization, isn't taking a position on anything.
Sure, it's not.
I understand you can oftentimes confuse its members for the organization.
It doesn't wink, take positions just like, come on. I mean,
well, when
litmus test and I mean, again, it doesn't take positions, but its viewpoints are pretty well known in many of its symposiums and its many of its meetings. Like the last week's was not one, again, that was on
these issues,
but right.
It doesn't have that kind of valence, but you go to your typical, and you know this because you tried to help me find somebody who was going to balance me out in my position on this particular amendment. I wanted to have someone who agreed with the amendment to Rule 1.16, because that would have been in the spirit of the kind of sessions that the Federal Society wants to have, which is to have a debate, to have a discussion about the topic. And that's the kind. So the forum that you saw at that in this is the kind of forum that you have at a Federal Society meeting where you have an issue of contention. And that is, you have people on one side, you have Juan Thomas and Ms. Rose and Attorney General Rosenblum on one side, and you have Professor Blackmun and Mr. Williamson on the other side. And they have a debate and they have a discussion. And then you have questions from the audience. That's the form these things, that's what I think is being sought. And then the question is, does the organization take a position on things? And if the mission of the organization is going to be to take position on contentious issues, then it doesn't matter what position that is. You're going to have fewer members. And
it is, yeah. No, that's for sure.
I wish that weren't. I would very much like to be a member of the ABA, but not with the positions that it takes. And so it makes it hard. It's the kind of organization, you know, it has a great deal of influence. The model rules, the other things that it does a lot of great work, but it does things that I can't agree with. I wish it didn't do those things, but it does.
Yeah,
that's its choice, as is my choice. So, it's very. We'll see what happens with this resolution. I expect it would be highly contentious were it to reach the floor of the House of Delegates. I think that there'd be many members who want the organization to do more. And this kind of proposal asks for it to do less or do different things. So with that, we will take our leave and we'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast. Thanks for joining.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.